This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757 outside the area, and you may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. And today we begin our conversation the day after Thanksgiving with Jay Perkins, former associate professor of mass communication at LSU, and for 15 years he covered Capitol Hill, the White House, and political campaigns for the Associated Press. It's been quite a month. President Obama becomes just the fourth American president to be elected twice in the last century, with over 50% of the votes both times. The others who did this were named Roosevelt, Reagan, and Eisenhower. Good morning, Jay Perkins. Jay, as far as how it turned out on November 6th, how do you explain the fact that so many pundits and pollsters, prognosticators had it so wrong?
Well, they didn't. Now, Fox News had it wrong, but most of the polls were within the margin of error. So, I mean, you could interpret them either way, but the fact is, if you looked at the average, which is what Nate Silver did at the New York Times, the trend was clear from the start. I mean, anyone looking at those poll averages 3 to 4 weeks out knew that Obama was going to likely win. Plus, if you look at it from a state-by-state basis, everyone kept talking about how the Romney had a very tough road to get to win the election because the states he had to win. And Real Clear Politics, for example, said it was almost impossible for him to win, but people didn't pay attention to it.
Well, President Obama won by a substantial margin. The latest look at the popular vote has him at 64,182,000 and Mitt Romney at 60,067,000. That's 4,115,000 votes separating the two of them, and that's in the popular vote, which, of course, is more or less a beauty contest because it's the Electoral College that counts, and the margin in the Electoral College was 332 to 206. The only states that the president did not win in 2012 that he carried in 2008 were Indiana and North Carolina. Nonetheless, respected people like Dick Morris, he was calling for not only for a Romney win but a Romney landslide. It looks like it was just wishful thinking on the part of some of these people.
A great deal of it is wishful thinking. It's also, a lot of it is public relations. I mean, you can't go out 2 or 3 days before the election is over and say, well, you know, the Republicans going to lose if you're a Republican consultant.
297-5633, if you'd like to join us. Jay Perkins is with us to talk about the presidential election. Nate Silver called every state correct. He's the young man who has this website, 538.com. And he has been on point the last two elections. Has he brought a new science to the process?
It wasn't just Nate Silver. Nate Silver was the public face of it. But the Obama campaign ran one of the most sophisticated get-out-the-vote campaigns ever done. Unbelievable. So, you could call this the election, the revenge of the nerds election. They really took over, and they've changed the nature of politics forever.
And now people are not only concentrating on individual states, they're concentrating on particular areas in individual states. So it's become such a scientific process, Jay, that not only, for example, Louisiana was not only ignored, but there were places in Ohio that were ignored too, and that was the battleground of all battlegrounds.
Absolutely. The Obama campaign knew. They mined voting records. They figured out who was likely to vote, who was not likely to vote, and then they found people who could turn out those who were not likely to vote by neighbors, friends, whatever, and they used that very effectively.
297-5633. If you would like to join Jay Perkins in the conversation on WRKF, Jim in Denham Springs. Good morning, Jim.
How you doing today?
I think the reason why the Republicans got it so wrong publicly was that you just need to follow the money, because these consultants, they want to keep money coming in because that's how they get paid. They're fundraisers. They get paid for going out and trying to gin up the base. And if they sit there and admit that, hey, look, it doesn't look good, then they don't make money. It was their own self-interest.
Well, there is big money involved in politics, and Jay, I'm sure there's some indication, as the other Jim stated, that people, for financial reasons, that they like the way the system is going right now.
Some people do like it, but what you see is that in the case of this particular election, Karl Rove raised $200 million, spent it, and got nothing out of it. His contributors are furious, of course.
$200 million. And, of course, he had a meltdown on Fox News on election night.
Yes, he did.
How does a partisan like Karl Rove, who was involved intricately in the Romney campaign, how does he get a seat at the table at a major news network on election night without being identified as a partisan?
Well, he was on the Republican propaganda channel.
Yes, he was. 297-5633 is your number. Mike in Spanish Town. Mike, good morning. You're on with Jay Perkins.
Good morning. I want to commend your guest on the answers that he's giving you, specifically that it wasn't just Nate Silver. There were a whole group of aggregators or meta-analysis analysts, as they're called, and that the race really wasn't too close to call. It was too close for any single poll to call. And that I think a lot of the confusion in the public's mind was not that the problem was that complicated, only that the journalism was so poor who insisted on reporting the election as if it were a football game instead of something that could actually be measured and predicted with some reliability. So, again, my compliments to your guest.
Right. Well, there is a horse race or a football game, however you want to determine it. It's almost like a sporting event, Jay. And journalists, I found through the years, are not the best when it comes to crunching numbers. That's not what they do usually.
I barely could add and subtract myself.
Well, what about the horse race aspect? That we like to play up the fact that there's one side against the other, and they got the handlers, and you got the pundits who are on each side, and of course after the debates. In fact, during the debate, I read that David Axelrod was on the phone saying, "We're in trouble. We've got to craft a message right now," as the first debate was going on when the president wasn't doing particularly well. There's definitely an aspect to this that smacks of an athletic competition.
Yes, and here's the basic problem. Journalists are really good at simplifying complex issues, and in the process, they lose a lot of the nuances. But the other problem is they're really good at selling newspapers because that's their basic function, is to make money for their owner. And so, of course, everything is hyperbolic. This poll, the latest poll, has to be shouted out from the tops of the towers, you know, that this is the latest, greatest thing. So there's an element of hyperbole to everything that's in the newspaper today.
Well, it's a 3.3% gap right now between the president and Mitt Romney. And mind you, votes are still coming in, which is another reason why this process we have may be flawed a bit. 50.8% for the president, 47.5% for Romney. Romney has surpassed now by a few thousand votes John McCain's total in 2008. So now there are only two men in the history of American politics, I believe, and I'll recheck, who have eclipsed 60 million votes in an election, and they are Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. Romney got a lot of votes. In fact, he got more votes in Louisiana than any candidate in the history of Louisiana for any race. But the president got 800 and some odd, I think under 808,000. That's more votes than Bobby Jindal has received in any of his three runs for governor. So the first person out of the gate to criticize the Romney campaign, to my knowledge, was our governor, Bobby Jindal. Is he scoring points with his analysis of the election?
I don't really think so. It's It's really hard to tell this early out because we're still shaking down from this election. But, yeah, he was out there right at the front. Now, he's got a problem. He's got to do something to establish himself as a front runner for the next election, and so he has to be out there. But I don't think he really did himself any favors by criticizing the Romney campaign.
Well, and today in the Baton Rouge Advocate, there is an editorial from Cal Thomas, who has called Jindal's performance in Louisiana miraculous. And he is obviously on the Marco Rubio train for 2016. There are many aspirants out there who would like to be the Republican nominee for president in 4 years. And if the governor runs, as is expected, he's going to have a lot of company, isn't he?
He is. And it's going to be very interesting to see where the Republican Party is in 4 years, because it's going to either have to become more moderate or it's going to have to become even more conservative. It can't stay where it is right now. But the problem they've got is the percentage of white vote is declining 2% every year. And so if the, as long as they continue to be the party of angry white men, as Lindsey Graham called them, they've got a problem.
HB in Denham Springs, you're on the air with Jay Perkins. Good morning, HB.
Good morning. One comment, maybe in a comment from your guest. On the Sunday morning news shows, I'm talking about the National, George Stephanopoulos and the rest of them, I'm on there. It seems like professional etiquette has went out the window, because the moderator or the host of the show, unlike Mr. Jim, he loses control over his guest, and so many of them start talking and hollering at one time, you cannot understand anything that they're saying. Your opinion, please, sir. Thank you.
Well, that's the nature of politics today. It's really easy and it's cheap for television to get a couple of talking heads up there screaming at each other. And it makes for good TV, but it does not make for good politics or good political commentary.
And I did check. George Bush did get across the 60 million mark in 2004, and John Kerry got 59 million votes in that election. That was a much closer election, by the way, than this one. 50.7% to 48.3%, that's 2.4%. This one is now 3.3%. And yet, now history regards Kerry as a big loser. He almost won that election.
He almost did.
Mm-hmm.
That's the nature of politics today.
And it is that the victors get the spoils, and if you lose an election, you're pretty much history. There are those who say that if Romney got a few thousand votes here and a few thousand votes there, he would have gotten enough votes to win in the Electoral College. And if you tabulate them, it's only a few million votes. Well, you could do the exact same thing. In fact, somebody's already done it with Michael Dukakis. And when you do that on a state-by-state basis, Dukakis was closer to winning in 1988 than Mitt Romney was two Tuesdays ago.
Mm-hmm. The problem Republicans have today is they gave women the right to vote. Now, 55% of those women voted for Obama, and that's what really swings the election now.
And it was 53% of the overall votes were from women.
Yes.
So when you dominate a demographic group like that, the biggest of them all, you got a pretty good shot of winning.
You sure do.
And in these polls, I think they break it down pretty close, like 50-50 men and women. And it would turn out to be 53-47. So
yes,
that perhaps explains why the president did better than anticipated. We'll talk more with Jay Perkins after this brief timeout on WRKF.
They say you are what you eat, so how much media do you consume every day? Are you gorging yourself on everything in sight? Snacking between meals? Sneaking the occasional tweet? I'm Audie Cornish. Look, if you've tried all the other news outlets but just aren't seeing results, check out the All Things Considered diet. Weekdays. More news, less filler.
Brought to you by LSU Foundation.
Weekdays at 3 p.m. on 89.3 WRKF.
Support for the Jim Inkster Show provided by Luba Workers' Comp. For over 20 years, Luba has provided workers' compensation coverage to businesses throughout Louisiana and now Arkansas and Mississippi. LubaWC.com. Luba Workers' Comp. Genuine dependability.
And by East Baton Rouge Parish Recycling. With a compost bin and rain barrel sale with mulch available. Saturday, December 1st, 9 to 2 at Memorial Stadium. For East Baton Rouge Parish residents only. brgov.com/recycle.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Jay Perkins with us a bit longer, former Associated Press Washington correspondent for 15 years. And he taught at LSU for how long?
Oh, 27 years.
27 years. And some of his proteges have done very well in the journalism business, including Stephanie Regal, the editor of Business Report, and Rod Dreher.
Rod Dreher.
Who's a big-time conservative guy.
Big-time conservative and very influential columnist.
And cited by David Brooks of the New York Times as one of the Republicans who really counts in the way that he influences other people.
Yes. Who would have thunk it?
We need to get him on the show, but I recall him telling a story on this show about driving Abby Hoffman around when Abby was still alive and visiting LSU, and those two together.
When Rod was liberal for a while there, and then he became conservative again.
But he maybe it was Abby who turned him in the other direction. Today, in the Baton Rouge Advocate, as I noted, Cal Thomas says, Rubio has the message the Republican Party needs. It's a long way to 2016, and there are many good potential presidential candidates, but Marco Rubio could be the one candidate conservatives have been waiting for, the second coming of Ronald Reagan. That's not good news for Bobby Jindal.
No, it's not. But, you know, the thing that he misses there is that Ronald Reagan probably couldn't get the election, the nomination from the Republican Party today.
Not as the Ronald Reagan who ran in 1980.
Exactly.
So it is something that you bring up that I think is pertinent, that in order to get the nomination, a candidate on the Republican side generally has to go right. And now the electorate is becoming more moderate or perhaps a bit left of center. So how can you move so quickly from the far right or close to the far right to the middle? It's a tough maneuver, isn't it?
I think Romney showed that it's almost an impossible movement. He basically ended up as a flip-flopper in the public eye because his positions had to change so drastically in order to win the nomination and then drastically again to move back to the middle for the general.
Dorothy on Goodwood, please be brief. Dorothy, you're on with Jay Perkins.
Hi. Happy belated Thanksgiving. My point is this. A lot of people voted for Obama not because they were voting against Romney, but because Romney had no message. We voted for Obama because he was standing for something and because he had a message.
All right. Well, what about the lack of message from Mitt Romney? Is that a valid?
I think he had a message. It wasn't one that appealed to a lot of people. His message was, "We've got to go back to the good old days." But you know, if you look at the good old days, the Republicans like to talk about the 1950s. The tax rate in 1950 was 92%. That's the top marginal tax rate. It's 35% now. That really destroys their whole message.
Yeah, well, that was when Dwight David Eisenhower became president of the United States.
Yes, it was.
And it didn't change much under Eisenhower.
It certainly didn't. It dropped to 90%.
a big 2%. Well, Lanny Keller of The Advocate closes his column today by saying there is time for Governor Jindal to be engaged in a more meaningful discussion of policy changes that might give the GOP a better shot at the presidency in 2016. His first efforts along these lines, aside from a little borrowing from Senator Vitter, remind those of us in Louisiana that all of the Jindal whose rhetoric is that of an all-you-can-eat special at the Platitudes buffet. Lanny's saying that, kind of like what Walter Mondale said about Gary Hart, where's the beef? And Governor Jindal says the Republican Party, he says, needs to change its ways, but he isn't saying how.
No, he's not. And it's probably smart of him not to say how at this point, because who knows what's going to be the complexion of the country in 4 years. I mean, let's face it, in 4 years, all of the gains from the previous 4 years under Obama are going to be cemented. Try to get rid of Obamacare 4 years from now. It's an entitlement at that point. So you're going to see a change in the way people look at government. You're also going to have a change at the Supreme Court level.
You think some people will be leaving?
Well, you've got two people appointed who are 79 years old, Scalia and Kennedy. You've got two, they're 76. You've got Ruth Bader Ginsburg at 79. You've got Stephen Breyer at 76. Yeah, there's going to be some changes.
You know, of course, two of those are Democratic appointees, Breyer and Ginsburg, so there probably wouldn't be a substantial change on the way the court votes. But the other two...
The other two will be a huge change, yes.
But they will probably try to hold on for another 4 years or so, waiting to see what will happen in 2016. That's generally the way it works.
Right.
And speaking of 2016, there's a headline today in the front page of the New York Times, Jeb Bush in 2016. It's not too early for chatter. Could we have another Bush?
Oh, I hope not. I mean, we don't need a family dynasty type of politics.
We could have a Bush against a Clinton again.
We could.
We could.
And, that, you know, that's not the way it ought to be in the U.S.
Jeb Bush against Hillary Clinton. Well, and also another story that is out there today that I think warrants some attention. It says that in 37 states, one party controls both houses of the legislature and the governor's office, Louisiana being one of the 37. 24 of those states are controlled by Republicans and 13 by Democrats, which just solidifies the partisan divide in this country.
Yes, it does.
So what does that mean, if anything?
I think we're going to probably still be divided in 4 years. But the point of division is shifting toward the Democratic majority each year. As I said, you know, you're seeing a decline in the percentage of white vote. You're seeing a rise in the percentage of women voting. You see a toward the Democrats. You see a rise in the Latino votes. If the Republicans don't do something drastic in the next few years, they're going to lose their party.
Well, an observation from Kevin. He says that we're being too hard on Governor Jindal for switching horses right after the election, after Romney lost, and jumping off that horse and onto a new one, his own, saying this is done all the time. Well, not all the time. Jessica Kane, who is producing today, has found a cut from Bob Smith, a former senator from New Hampshire who was on this show before the election, a Republican, mind you, from a neighboring state where Mitt Romney was the leader. Romney, of course, was governor of Massachusetts. Here's Bob Smith on Mitt Romney before the election.
Leadership is, you know, to use the Spanish term, cojones. I mean, you got to have them. You got to be willing to stand up to the establishment. Leadership is action. I really, really have grave concerns about Mitt Romney, and I don't think he can win.
He was right.
He's right.
And he had the fortitude to say it before the election. Bobby Jindal was out there talking about a Romney victory and how it'd be great for the country. Why wasn't he making these statements, Jay, before the election rather than post November 6?
Well, I think because he's planning to run for president himself, and it's not smart to knock down your own candidate's party candidate.
And Chris Christie's getting a lot of heat. He really didn't do that. All he did was say nice things about Barack Obama during Superstorm Sandy, and now he is persona non grata in some of the Republican ranks.
But this is the whole thing, you know. I mean, they've got to find a scapegoat. And the easiest way to find a scapegoat is to pick on somebody like Christie, who basically said, thank you, President Obama, for responding.
That's all he said.
That's it.
Well, it is an interesting time, and Chris Christie, I think, is the most dynamic of all the Republicans out there, but he is a man. He needs to trim down a bit if he's going to run for president. I don't think he could withstand the rigors of a campaign.
Probably not.
And it is remarkable how these candidates, Romney has done it twice now. They just go from one end of the country to another and make three or four stops a day, and it's amazing they don't lose their mind along the way.
It's very easy to do. I mean, I covered political campaigns. It is one of the most exhausting things that can happen. I mean, you just after a week on the campaign, you're so tired you just cannot think straight.
And that's for the journalists.
Right. Exactly.
And the candidates have a bit more skin in the game. And Romney, you can imagine that he's surrounded himself with people who think like he does and are hopeful that he wins. And he probably is watching Fox News, and they're reinforcing victory. On election night, he thought he was going to win. He'd only prepared one speech, and that was a victory speech.
Yes.
And I thought, under the circumstances, he was gallant and gracious, and he handled it like a champ.
He did. And, you know, you're seeing pictures now of Romney, the real Romney, coming out. There was some pictures of him at Disneyland with his family. And he's a much more likable person now that he's not running for president.
That quite often happens. It really does. And of course, once you lose, everything you did was terrible. And when you win, you're brilliant. And Romney lost. So yes. We probably heard the last and seen the last as a presidential aspirant for Mitt Romney. In fact, it is so quick, Jay, that I'm not even sure he'll have a place at the convention in 2016. It's that fast.
I know.
And if he had gotten 4 million more votes, he would be running for re-election and would be ordained as the candidate again by the Republicans. But it's a case in which if you don't win, it doesn't matter what the margin, you're pretty much through. And Al Gore is an example of that. He won the popular vote, and he was nowhere to be found at this convention.
It's what have you done for me lately?
Well, Bobby Jindal, I'm sure, will be front and center. 2016. In fact, New Orleans, I think, is still trying to get the Republican convention, but I can't imagine them coming to New Orleans because we're no longer a swing state.
No, I wouldn't come here if I were the Republican Party at this point.
But in 1988, they did, and the first George Bush won. And since then, since New Orleans 1988, the Republicans in the popular vote have won only one time. And that was a close race between Bush, the second Bush, and John Kerry. So New Orleans is the last time the Republicans actually won in what might be considered a landslide.
Mm-hmm.
When Bush beat Michael Stanley Dukakis up one side and down the other. Thank you, Jay Perkins. And I hope you have a good rest of the holiday. And thanks for spending Black Friday with us.
No problem. Thanks.
And we're joined now by Bud Johnson. He was LSU Sports Information Director from 1958 to 1971, and he's written the definitive book about the 58 champions, The Perfect Season. The last time LSU went through a season in football without losing a game was 1958, 54 years ago. Bud Johnson, you were a young man then.
Good morning, Jim. Actually, in 1958, I was the assistant sports information director.
Okay, and you became the actual SID?
In 66.
In 66. So you were there from 58 to 65.
71.
As assistant, and then 66 to 71 as the main guy. So I guess Ace Huggins was the...
Ace Higgins.
Ace Higgins, excuse me. Bron Higgins' father was the SID at the time. And 1958, you were a very young man. You had arrived in campus, what, just a year earlier?
I got out of the Army in December and went to work for LSU in February 1st, 1958.
February 1st, 1958, and at that time there was no idea that it would be a magical season and one that has not been replicated since. And we'll get to today's game against the University of Arkansas. But Paul Dietzel, he'd been there 3 years prior to 1958. Had he done anything to indicate there would be that kind of success in 1958?
The 57 season gave a glimmer of things to come. Billy Cannon outgained the Heisman Trophy winner. And it was the number two rusher on the LSU team. I saw them play while I was in the service. I saw them play at Texas Tech, and sophomores scored all three LSU touchdowns.
So
in a 19-12 win.
So
Cannon scored two, and mm-hmm. Robinson caught a pass from Rabb, another sophomore.
All right.
So they had a tailspin. A lot had to do with a flu virus, but there had to be a little excitement about Billy Cannon. Mm-hmm. They had a big, fast running back coming back, and if they could maximize a new offense, get Robinson into the running game, and have a threat of a pass with Warren Rabb. Nobody could forecast the season they had, but there was some optimism within the inner circle. Let me put it that way.
Well, 1958 set the pace for everything that's happened since. There was not the kind of enthusiasm for LSU football then, and that changed everything, didn't it?
I can remember the home opener with Hardin-Simmons. They had a crowd of 45,000.
For the home opener in 1958.
And the community kind of wanted to wait and see what LSU was going to do before they would commit to it. When they played the first SEC game in 58 with Kentucky, they had a crowd of 65,000. And the sudden demand for the LSU football ticket happened that week.
And that was capacity at the time?
No, capacity was 67.
So they
67.5.
2,000 short?
And they would meet capacity in the Ole Miss game. And that occurred because of the wisdom of the athletic business manager, Jack Gilmore, who passed away recently. He didn't have a very big staff. There was no computer ticketing in those days. So he wisely put 15,000 end zone seats as general admission. So the ticket buyer could walk to the counter and say, I want four or two,
mm-hmm.
not where are they, where can I get two together or whatever.
Well, I think the point that comes from what you're saying is that the crowds are often reflective of the success on the field. Here, LSU is expanding to 100,000 seats by 2014 with the addition on the south side of Tiger Stadium. And not so long ago, 1989 to 99, 11 seasons, LSU had eight losing seasons. What happens if the bottom falls out of LSU football? Will they be able to fill 100,000 seats?
I don't think so, but I think the this is a vote of confidence for the present regime, I would say, more than anything. If they don't believe in this coaching staff, then they certainly shouldn't increase the capacity.
Mm-hmm. Since we had Jay Perkins on, a listener has emailed saying that Governor Jindal doesn't go to many games, and I think he's right. Governors used to, that was part of the job, right? They had to be at Tiger Stadium on Saturday night.
Well, it was a place to be seen, let me put it that way. There was no governor who loved it more than John McKithen, let me say that.
Well, he was the wild exception. He was out there recruiting and getting involved almost as a coach on the team. Governor Jindal's not doing much coaching of the LSU football team, but they seem to be doing okay without him. And and they'll be playing today at 1:30 in Fayetteville, Arkansas. LSU coming in with a record of 9-2, and the Razorbacks have had a terrible season. They are 4-7 and 12-point underdogs. And we'll talk more with Bud Johnson after this one-minute pause on WRKF.
Keeping up with the news has never been more important or more expensive. That's why WRKF is asking for your tax-deductible contribution as this year comes to a close. All it takes is a gift of a dollar or two a week. The money you give will go directly into paying for the NPR news you use now and into next year. It will also help ensure that WRKF is available for the entire community. If you received a letter asking for your gift, please send your check today or give online at WRKF.org. That's WRKF.org, and thank you.
Capital Area CASA is recruiting volunteers to ensure that every abused and neglected child in East Baton Rouge Parish will find a safe, permanent home. More information on upcoming training sessions at casabr.org. The Friends of the Library Christmas in the Country Tour of Homes will be held Sunday, December 2nd, with proceeds benefiting the West Feliciana Parish Library. Ticket information at 225-635-3364.
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Bud Johnson, former LSU SID. He was a sports information director at LSU during some great seasons, 1966 to 1971. And before that, he was the right-hand man of Ace Higgins from 65 to 71. That period was comparable to this one. In that LSU won a national title, won three SEC titles. And during the last 13 years, LSU, I think, has won four SEC titles and two national titles. And Bud Johnson, there was a lull between those ages. And I would say that probably the current era is one that has eclipsed the one that you were involved with, even as great as it was.
I would be glad to endorse that. I certainly was excited by and enjoyed the success that LSU had when I was there. But this run that Saban and Miles have put together have established LSU as a national team. And I think every year they're going to be expected by the pundits to be a team that could take it all.
297-5633, LSU playing later today against Arkansas at Fayetteville, where the Tigers last played 20 years ago and lost 30-6 under the reign of Hudson Curly Hallman. Bud Johnson is with us, and Chris Andrews is calling in. Good morning, Chris.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson mentioned Jack Gilmore a moment ago, and I was honored to officiate his memorial service several weeks ago. At that service, one of his grandchildren shared a story that I think is a bit of Tiger trivia. I'll be real quick. When Jack Gilmore and Paul Dietzel were here in their early years, things were not looking good, and the press and everyone in town was saying they should go back from where they came before they got into the national championship. Anyway, one morning, 2:30 in the morning, the AD calls Mr. Gilmore and says, "Get over here to Mike Tiger's cage." They looked, they said it's either a very relaxed tiger or a very dead tiger, and Mike had expired during the night.
Oh, my.
And the two of them, along with some campus security, decided that if this got out, with the team being as poorly performing as it was, they would really be run out of town. Even Mike had given up on them. So they decided on the spot, according to this story from family lore, to load the tiger up, take it out onto the levee somewhere, and bury it. And then quickly made a call to a zoo in Michigan, got a new tiger shipped down to New Orleans, brought it in. So when you see Mike, whatever our number is now, there should be one more number after that, according to the Gilmore family lore. Anyway, I thought it was a cute story.
Yeah, that is a great story.
I wanted to share it with you.
Thank you, Chris.
So,
thank
all
you.
Right, have a good day.
You Thanks. Too. Have you heard that one?
I have heard that one.
Yeah?
But we didn't tell it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bud worked briefly at Tulane University. How many years?
7 years.
7 years. And during that time, some Tulanians came to Baton Rouge and let Mike out of his cage. And he was roaming down Nicholson Drive, and it took several tranquilizer shots to bring him down and keep him from munching on some passerby. There have been a number of pranks involving Mike the Tiger, haven't there, through the years?
Yes, the one that I'm very familiar with, the actor Ed Nelson told me this story. He was a Tulane cheerleader at the time, and he was a part of the tiger napping of 1950. It seems that the cheerleaders from LSU were in charge of the tiger, and they brought it to New Orleans. And this guy had a date, this cheerleader had a date with a girl, Newcomb co-ed, and he took her to Ye Olde College Inn, and he parked a tiger, the portable tiger cage behind Ye Olde College Inn. And the Tulane cheerleader saw it, unhitched it, and drove off into the night. now, headlines in the paper, you know, had demands that the Tiger be returned or there would be no game. The boy whose home they drove it to was in uptown New Orleans, and he parked a Tiger cage in his garage. His father walked down that morning to open the garage door, get in his car, and saw before him Mike the Tiger. So he rudely woke up his son and said, "If you don't take this thing back, I'm going to call the cops, and I hope they arrest you."
Well, LSU and Tulane, the passions ran high, as you know. And when Bud was there, there was a period where Tulane actually was winning, and they beat LSU 3 out of 4 years from 79 to 82. But why was that series canceled? That seems to be a bit of a disappointment.
I think probably the administrations on both sides couldn't agree. I think LSU wanted to play every game in Baton Rouge, and I think Tulane wanted some games in New Orleans. I don't know the particulars, but I think that's an essence. That's a basis of it.
It would seem, though, that LSU playing in New Orleans would be a good thing.
I would think so. I think if you open the season in the Superdome every year, while both teams are undefeated, you would have a marketable commodity.
And the reality is such that when LSU and Tulane play in the Superdome, most of the fans are for LSU.
Sadly, that's the case.
You're saying sadly because it's Tulane's home arena, but that's just the way it is.
Well, since the advent of the Saints, Tulane fan base has steadily declined, and you can't have losing season upon losing season and keep your fans excited about the future.
What a boneheaded move it was for Tulane to get out of the Southeastern Conference. Why did they do that in 1966?
I think they felt like, at the time, of course, I was at LSU then, and I think the athletic director felt like if he could manage the schedule, he could play a representative schedule without having to play Alabama and Ole Miss and LSU every year, that they could win enough games to keep their fans interested and compete with the Saints.
Well, today LSU closes its regular season against the University of Arkansas. It seems that barring something really unexpected, LSU is out of the hunt for the national championship. But, you know, as a loss today, for example, it would be a real downer, wouldn't it? LSU needs to win this game.
It would be, and really, Wilson is probably one of the best passers in the conference. And if LSU has a weakness defensively, you have to say that young defensive secondary. So a good passing game by Arkansas and some mishaps in the LSU secondary, that could certainly put Arkansas an upset winner.
Well, no LSU team has had a perfect season since 1958. LSU went 11-0 and won the national championship. The closest the Tigers have come, 2 13-1 seasons, the 2003 national champions, and last year's team that lost to Alabama in the BCS championship game. So if you want to take a trip back to 1958, Bud Johnson's The Perfect Season is a place to go. John Ed Bradley says it should be required reading for even the most casual observer of the college football scene. For LSU fans, writes John Ed, you'll want to memorize it from start to finish and sleep with it under your pillow at night. This book is that good. That's pretty good to get a testimonial from a writer like Mr. Bradley.
I told him I was going to have to write the book over after what he said.
Well, congratulations on the success for The Perfect Season, which came out a few years ago. And as I said, it is the definitive book about the magic year of 1958 when Dwight Eisenhower was president, Earl Long was governor. Who was mayor of Baton Rouge then?
Elvis was the king.
Elvis was the king. A lot of things were different in 1958. But it was a great year for LSU and for Bud Davis, who arrived on February 1st, and little did he know that he would be part of a national championship team. Did you get a ring or any kind of thing to go?
I do have a ring.
You do?
I don't wear it. It's kind of cumbersome.
They gave big rings in those days, didn't they?
Well, not as big as the ones today.
Well, you've done well, and we're glad you're still with us. And I tell you what, not next month, but January 5th, will mark the 25th anniversary of the parting of Pete Maravich, a man that Bud Johnson knew well. So we will call on you again. Thank you, Bud.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care. We're joined now by a writer, Beth Gale, who has written a compelling book, And Then Came the Angels, A True Story of Faith and Determination. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming this way, and this is a story that is a very personal one for you.
Yes, it is.
What happened?
Well, basically, it's a story about a miracle, Jim, that occurred in our son's life, and we feel like we've witnessed something that is not often something everybody sees. Our older son, Gip, was in a hunting accident, shot in the head, and not expected to survive the night. But by God's grace, we are all here today.
How old was Gip when the accident occurred?
He was 19. He was 3 weeks into his freshman year of college.
And where was he going to school?
University of West Georgia.
And it was a near-fatal, that's the important message, near-fatal hunting accident.
Right.
19-year-old Gip Gale. How long ago was that?
It's been 9 years.
9 years. Well, what happened that night, and why was it considered to be a dire case in which Gip would not survive?
Well, he was shot in the right front corner of his skull, and it was birdshot, so it just penetrated all through the entire area of his skull and into his brain and destroyed it, literally, the blast, and then damaged the rest of his brain from the impact. So he was life-flighted to a level one trauma center several hours away, and when we got the call, they were not even able to tell us if he had survived the life flight.
But he did survive.
Yes, he did.
And like these things go, there's a process involved. What was your immediate reaction when you saw him?
We crumbled. It was devastating to see him and to really even believe it. I think our first reaction was shock. And utter devastation.
But when we say survive, he is whole.
He is whole. So. Yes, he is. It took a long time. It took a lot of surgeries. It took a lot of therapy. And it took a lot of prayers. And by God's grace, we had a lot of prayers.
And shot in the head. So as neurological issues go, it takes some time to come back. It also takes some time to determine the amount of damage done. At what point did you know he had turned the corner?
Well, there were several corners, Jim. Actually, we almost lost our son quite a few times over the course of several years. He had a lot of setbacks, over 20-something surgeries and procedures, and we faced near death on numerous occasions because of infections, and his wound continued to open, and there were just a lot of trials and trauma throughout several years. But he fought. We had so many wonderful people praying for us and reaching out to help us, and that's why I named the book And Then Came the Angels, because for us, September 6, 2003, our lives were shattered, and then God sent earthly angels to carry us through it.
Dr. Lewis Horn, the chief neurosurgeon of Memorial University Medical Center in Savannah, says when Gip Gale arrived via life flight at our trauma center, his condition was extremely critical. He had suffered a very severe brain injury, and we knew his survival was in question. He and his family have been through an ordeal that would test the faith of the best of us and that most will never experience. I have no doubt that the love of family and their faith in God was and is a critical part of Gip's recovery. And it happened on September 6, 2003. What's life like now for Gip?
Well, I feel so blessed to say that Gip has just made an amazing recovery, and he has gone back to college after 5 years and graduated this past May. And it was through that journey, and as things started really turning around, that we realized even more so now just how big the miracle has been. And we meet with a lot of families in different hospitals and try to share the hope that from the blessings that we were given, and try to encourage others to hold on and fight hard and never give up. And through those families, we've been encouraged to tell our story and write the book, because we can only see so many people in person. But if we tell the story and put it in writing, hopefully it'll reach a lot more.
And then came the angels, a true story of faith and determination from Beth Gale about her son, Richard Gibson Gale. It's apparent from your remarks and from the book that you believe that there has been divine intervention.
No doubt about it. God is alive and well and still performing miracles. And if you don't believe that, please read the book.
Does Gip share that?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We all do. Our whole family has been on this journey together, so we've all survived.
Well, some of us have survived things that have been tough in life, maybe not as tough as this, but why do you think God intervenes in some cases and not in others?
Oh, my gosh, Jim, I am completely inept to answer that question. That's just a mystery of God, and that's the way I would have to leave it. We're just thankful that for whatever reason he spared our son's life, and we believe because of that we're supposed to share this story and hope that it will encourage others to battle on.
Jeff Foxworthy, the comedian, he says, Gip and his family have elevated my belief in the power of prayer. Their story will lift your spirits as it strengthens your faith. Where can you get the book?
In a lot of different bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You can also go online to Amazon.com and purchase it that way. So it's out there.
Well, thank you for sharing an inspirational story, Beth Gale, the story of Gip Gale. And then came the angels, a true story of faith and determination. Have a great weekend, everybody, and thank you for listening. We'll be back Monday. J.C. Kane producing today. We thank her. Thank you, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.